Coming up on Tech News Today, Twitter gets hacked, but I think it won the Super Bowl. Also, Chromebooks getting more popular and how to run Windows on Android. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, February 4th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT2. And they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control. And by The Resumator. Streamline hiring and increase traffic to job postings with The Resumator, the hiring solution used by today's fastest-growing companies. For a free trial, go to theresumator.com/TNT. And by Podio from Citrix. Manage your projects with files, instant communication, and collaboration all in one workplace. Start using Podio today. It's free. Just visit Podio.com to sign up, set up your first workspace, and invite your team to get started. Work the way you want to with Podio.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Ayaz Akhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the Fuse Day News. Is it me or the News Fuse intros getting more violent over time?
I think more awesome.
Yeah, they're more Michael Bay.
Those two are not mutually exclusive, mind you. HP joined in the recent series of companies introducing new Chromebooks with the announcement of the HP Pavilion 14. The $330 laptop running Google's Chrome OS is one of the biggest with a 14-inch screen. Acer and Samsung recently added new Chromebooks to their lines as well. HP's Chromebook ships in the United States starting today.
In last night's big ol' Super Bowl game, a lot of folks were most interested not really in the game, but the ads. Twitter was mentioned in 26 of 52 national television commercials, which is 50% of the spots that aired during CBS's game coverage. Facebook was mentioned in 4 of those commercials. That's about 8%. Google Plus, which is supposedly the number 2 social network in the world, not mentioned. Not even once.
The New York Times has published a piece about the United States cyber warfare policies, citing anonymous officials. A secret legal review found if the U.S. detected credible evidence of a potential digital attack, the president could order a preemptive strike even if there is no declared war. An official told the Times that the U.S. considers cyber weapons so powerful that only direct orders from the president should warrant their use.
HTC's future looks pretty dismal. The Taiwanese smartphone maker said Monday it expects its Q1 revenue to be flat to 17% lower than the previous quarter and lower than analysts expected. HTC's chief financial officer, Chang Chia Lin, told investors it would start targeting more affordable smartphones in China and target emerging markets going forward.
The FCC wants to create super Wi-Fi networks across the nation, powerful and broad enough so that consumers could make calls or surf the internet without paying a bill every month. Analysts say this proposal has shaken the $178 billion wireless industry, now lobbying to persuade policymakers to reconsider this idea. But campaigns from Google, Microsoft, and other tech companies are pushing for this Wi-Fi service, saying an explosion of innovations and devices would benefit most Americans.
The $25 Model A Raspberry Pi computer is now on sale in Europe. The Raspberry Pi Foundation says that the Model A will be available to the rest of the world very soon. The Model A is the stripped-down version of the Raspberry Pi. It has one USB port, 256 megabytes of RAM, and no Ethernet, but it's $25.
For some reason, people seemed very excited that Apple owned the domain name appstore.com, which redirects to the iOS App Store. The URL was featured at the end of a trailer for Star Trek Into Darkness during yesterday's United States National Football League Championship match. New short links for App Store content was announced to developers last week. But this is the first time, I guess, we've seen it in the wild.
Google's trying to make peace with regulators in Europe. A day before penalties could be imposed, the company delivered a proposal to placate EU Competition Commissioner Joaquin Almunia. We don't know the specifics exactly, but Google's aim is to resolve the European Commission's antitrust investigation with the least possible disruption to Google's business. The company's previous proposal was not accepted by the commission, although on Friday, Google extended extended an olive branch to the tune of 60 million euro for the Digital Publishing Innovation Fund and a commitment to expand its partnerships with French publishers.
Friday was a big day for Twitter, too. The company announced it had detected an attack that accessed around 250,000 passwords, usernames, and email addresses. The passwords taken were salted and hashed, meaning they would be difficult to decrypt. Still, Twitter immediately reset the account passwords. Some security researchers criticized Twitter for not resetting the OAuth tokens. That means once you did reset your password, you could still use your apps like Twitter for Android without having to relog in.
Greg Sandoval has a new gig. He's the writer who quit CNET after its parent company, CBS, started exerting control over editorial content. Sandoval is now a part of The Verge as a senior reporter and starts in a few weeks.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace. It's fast. It's easy. It's a great way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Gives you and your website users the best mobile experience, too. I can't emphasize how cool that is. If you pick a template design, and they have award-winning designs at Squarespace, and you focus on putting in your content, getting your message up there, or putting your photos up there, it's easy to make it look good. And then you don't have to worry about, oh, wait a minute, what if somebody's on one of those little 3.5-inch screens? Or what if somebody's on a tablet that's 7 inches or 9 inches? They take care of all of that for you. 7 different versions are created of every image you add to your site so that the images fit in the mobile responsive design. The template actually adjusts itself to look good on different screens. And Squarespace is fast and easy to use, has beautiful templates, 100% drag and drop functionality. There's really... If you're looking to make a website, there's no reason to not go try it. It's absolutely free to try. They don't require you to give a credit card. They respect the fact that they want to make it easy for you to try it out. So go sign up for a free account. If you do decide to purchase Squarespace, use the offer code TNT2 and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That's squarespace.com. Use that offer code TNT2. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. All right, joining us now is Sean Hollister, editor at TheVerge.com. Also, full disclosure, he's married to my sister-in-law, so brother-in-law by extension. How's it going, Sean?
Good, good. And yourself?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. It's good to have you, especially we were going to have you on anyway, but then you were able to post your Chromebook review this morning, HP's Chromebook, HP Pavilion 14. Tell us a little bit about what you thought. I know you were messing around with this thing a bit.
Yeah. So HP told us that it's got its first Chromebook on the market. It's going to be $329.99, and it's basically one of their existing Pavilion computers with a Chrome OS on board and a lower powered Celeron processor inside. It's a 14-inch screen, so it's going to be a bit larger than the Chromebooks that have come before. But it's also only rated for about 4.5 hours of battery life, which is not particularly impressive for a computer that's just going to be browsing the web and running web apps and maybe some native client applications.
They're claiming 4 hours and 15 minutes of battery life. That's their claim. That's not a testing number.
Yeah. I don't know if that's going to be good enough for people who are going to want to take this on the go. Now, when I spoke to HP about it, they told me that they think that 80% of their users are just going to, you know, use it around the house. They'll be able to plug it in whenever they want. But if you have a laptop, if you want a laptop and you expect to take it with you, this might not be the one to do that.
A lot of these Chromebooks don't seem to have really great battery life. They do range in the 4 to 5 hour range. Acer recently came out with one, $199, though, cheaper than the HP, which is $330. Samsung has one for $250. But Acer, apparently, they told Bloomberg a while back that since November, Chromebooks have accounted for 5 to 10%. Of their U.S. shipments. Is this a trend? I mean, we've talked about this last week, but Now HP has really officially entered the race.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just bad news for Microsoft all around, because this is a free operating system. It doesn't require a ton of updating. I mean, and if the updates happen on Google's side anyway, so you get pushed all these updates, it's relatively maintenance-free. The idea that it's got that windowed interface, it's more familiar to people. As for all lining up these major players like HP, Lenovo for its education market, and Samsung's really cheap, $250. That one actually has a decent battery life compared to the other ones. been like 5 or 6 hours, actually.
If you've just got just a little bit of cash and you want a computer, it's hard to say no to $199, $250. It doesn't do everything the Windows machine will do. It won't do it quite as fast, but the price point is really hard to beat.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think people are also familiar with the concepts when it comes to netbooks. This is effectively a new netbook because it's so cheap, and you're not expecting a ton of power out of this. The fact that it can't do a whole lot, you're not going to be gaming on this device. But $330 is like the most expensive version. If that's the highest end, the $199 looks a lot more palatable.
I mean, even if you wanted a tablet, you're going to be paying more for most tablets than something like this. And some people like the idea of the laptop form factor more anyway.
And that Chrome OS store does give you a certain amount of apps. It may not be as full as say an iOS tablet app store or even Android's app store, but you can do multiple things with it. Is that the attraction? That's cheap?
I really think that's where it is. I mean, there's this hole in the laptop market now that netbooks are out of vogue, now that term is almost derogatory when you're talking about a laptop computer. If you want to buy a quality computer, you pay $800, you pay $1,000 for your laptop. But if you're looking for something and you just have a little bit of cash, you can get one of these. I just don't think people are going to be satisfied with the battery life. The netbooks, you know, when you the Asus EPC and the other netbooks came out, they'd give you, 6, 8, manufacturers quoted 12 hours of battery life. And now we're back down to 4, which is, basically what you're going to get from a Windows laptop anyhow.
Everybody talks about the post-PC era, and even if you kind of back off the hype and just say, well, yeah, desktops are going to continue to be around, but they're going to be limited in their appeal. They're going to be used for more specialty situations. That means fewer desktops are probably going to be sold. And if tablets take the middle of the market away, if Chromebooks start to eat away at laptops, how bad could this be for Microsoft?
Well, I mean, Microsoft's trying to figure out how to get their price points lower when it comes to the tablets with Windows 8, because that was one of the bigger issues Samsung had. They were saying, look, if we are going to put out an ARM-based Windows device, one, we have to spend a lot of money for education, and two, this is not worth it in trade-offs for the actual device. It wasn't powerful enough. I think it could be really bad news if Google can really, maybe if they come out with a high-end device, something that they can really show off, or maybe make Chrome OS a little bit more powerful, because that revision from that original full-screen browser to a windowed interface, I think that was a big step in the right direction. I don't know what else they could add, but I mean, if they can get more developers to help bolster the Chrome OS App Store, because that's separate from the Chrome browser store, that could help them out a lot. But Microsoft, I think they've really got to keep all their vendors in check, and that's probably why they were rumored to put money into Dell when Dell goes private.
All right, let's talk about this Twitter hack. Twitter announced Friday 250,000 user passwords, salted and hashed passwords still. Twitter did the right thing, said we're going to reset these passwords. Twitter Information Security Director Bob Lord said this was not the work of amateurs. He compared the attacks to the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. Washington Post admitted over the weekend that they had been attacked as well. Lord said the attacks were extremely sophisticated. We believe other companies and organizations have also been recently similarly attacked. And for that reason, we felt that it was important to publicize this attack while we still gather information. And we are helping government and federal law enforcement in their effort to find and prosecute the attackers to make the internet safer for all users. They also said beware of phishing emails. If you get an email that is purported to be from Twitter, maybe it's a direct message, don't click on any links in that email. Just go to twitter.com and try to log in as you normally would. If your password's been reset, it will tell you there. This is going to be a bonanza for spear phishing and regular phishing. Mike Isaac at All Things D says security researchers believe the announcements come in bunches because companies feel it's safer to come out and admit there was an attack when other people have admitted it. He says there's they actually quote Ashkin Soltari, a security researcher who's an independent security researcher, saying there's a herd mentality when it comes to disclosure. Having other companies disclose their breaches makes it easier for your company to, as you're less likely to get singled out in the press and the public eye. So the question is this spate of announcements of attacks because there is a group that's going after all these companies, or is it just that herd mentality of like, oh, okay, we had an attack, New York Times announced theirs, maybe it's okay to put ours out there? What do you think, Sean?
Well, I definitely think that there's a strong value to disclosing about, if you were attacked period now. After the PlayStation Network attack, which affected some 77 million accounts and really, really damaged the brand for a while, you know, you want to be able to tell your users right away if something's going on, or else you're going to get blamed for holding onto that information for even a small period of time. But I also think that, you know, like you say, if you can manage to time it so that there are multiple parties, you know, multiple different companies disclosing attacks at the same time, it does seem kind of like, you know, a wave, a crime wave or something, and you were just one of a few different companies affected by this thing, rather than, oh, take a look at Twitter, take a look at, you know, PlayStation Network, take a look at whatever the latest company that's been hacked and point the finger at them and say, oh, we can't trust them with our data. If there's a bunch of companies at the same time, you can say, well, these things happen.
Ayaz, is it just like learning a new word? You suddenly notice the attacks because one is got your attention?
I don't know if I don't know if it goes that way. I'm pretty sure it's just that if Twitter didn't say anything soon enough, people would freak out. It's like, why didn't you tell us about this? Why didn't you tell us? And that would cause a huge backlash. At this point, it's just a smart, proactive move by any of these companies to say, okay, something happened. We got to be upfront about this. Or otherwise, they're going to suffer a huge backlash by their user base, like the New York Times or anybody else. You want to make sure that you're controlling the message.
Sarah, did you get the email? Because I did.
Yeah, I did too.
So I did not. I went and I reset, and I was surprised when I went to my apps on both Android and iOS, and I didn't have to re-log in. Now, Twitter says that's because they feel secure enough that that's okay, that the OAuth tokens didn't need to be reset. But a lot of security researchers are picking on that. Did you feel that was a benefit of using OAuth? Like, oh, okay, now that I've reset my password, you know, I can decide. And they gave you, when you reset your password, a list of all the applications that have OAuth tokens, so mm-hmm. you could get rid of any that were weird. Did you like the convenience of that, or did you think it was a risky thing?
No, I liked it perfectly fine. I've changed my password. Somewhat recently had a situation where I had some app that, as far as I knew, I never had even used some service that tweeted out from me from my account in the middle of the night. And so I have sort of been in there and reneged access on quite a few services that I maybe have tried out once or twice, you know, for the purposes of research that I don't need. But yeah, I think it's always a really good exercise for folks to know that they're because of OAuth tokens, you have services that potentially can do things that you might not want them to do based on the fact that they are locked into your Twitter account. So this seems like an incident that Twitter's on top of. A lot of people got these, you know, hacking emails. You know, it's a good situation to think about your password and what you have connected to your Twitter account.
Hey, you know, that's a really good point. It's whether you had to reset or not, it's a good time to go review what applications have access to your Twitter account and weed out those ones that maybe you tried once and you forgot what were in
I think
there.
A lot of people would be surprised at what is actually connected. Now, many of you might not play around with all these sort of like social services, but I do. And it's like, I had like 100 services at one point. It's like, this is ridiculous. I don't even know the name of this.
Occupational hazard.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Twitter seems to have won the Super Bowl.
Twitter won the Super Bowl. Congrats, Twitter. If it couldn't have been the 49ers, at least it was Twitter. As I mentioned in the news views, there are obviously people who don't watch the Super Bowl. I know at least you're still familiar with the fact that the Super Bowl is not only a very big game, but also a big sort of event for advertising, and people sort of gather around the TV and watch ads that companies spend many, many, many millions of dollars for. Marketing Land basically combed through the national commercials from the opening kickoff of the game until when the clock reached, you know, zero time left on the game, only counted nationally sold commercials. So that's not spots that are sold and aired by local affiliate stations. Those aren't included because, you know, they're not national. And then also Marketing Land didn't include ads that were aired by the NFL or CBS promoting their own properties that might have had some social push in there. So of the actual ads during the Super Bowl from beginning to end, Twitter was mentioned in 26 of 52 national TV commercials. So that's half. I mean, Twitter was mentioned. And that doesn't mean go to our Twitter account necessarily. That could be a hashtag or a logo on the screen or a URL or something that is Twitter associated during that commercial that, you know, you either hear or you see or both. And Facebook was mentioned in 4 of the 52 commercials, so much fewer. That's about 8%. And then I mentioned, and this is me probably just crapping on Google a little bit, but Google Plus, not mentioned once, not mentioned once. And I don't think that that's so, so surprising, but we did just recently mention how Google Plus was supposedly the number two network, social network in the world behind Facebook. Twitter and YouTube were sort of neck and neck in like third and fourth place. So maybe so, but certainly not when it comes to the advertising agencies. And if you even compare this to last year, you think, well, you know, you see Twitter in half of the commercials, expensive commercials. Is that really a big deal? Last year, Twitter and Facebook each got 8 mentions out of a total of 59 counted national commercials. So slightly more commercials, but way less. So they were sort of neck and neck. Twitter gained more than 300% of these spots. And then Facebook saw a 50% drop in mentions because it had fewer mentions this year than last year. Now, I watched the Super Bowl from beginning to end, not happy with the way it turned out, but I did enjoy the ad part of it. I always do. And there were quite a few ads that I even went to Twitter, you know, and wrote out the hashtag that the commercial had pushed at me because I knew other people would get it because they had just watched it. I was having a good time with all of the stuff. I actually think that Twitter hashtags in this situation were really effective. So these numbers don't really surprise me. Ayaz, did you watch the game? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I watched the game and I saw all the hashtags. And I think one of the things is if for some reason you're unfamiliar with Twitter and you're like, how do I even ever get into this? These big commercials are a great way to get conversations going with a bunch of people you don't even know. Mm-hmm. You're just searching via hashtags. You're seeing that pop up in trending hashtags, I guess. And then you choose to read about all these things, and you end up following people. The weird thing is, I think this does, like, gangbusters for Twitter. I'm sure that they are connecting more and more people because I'm sure that people will follow each other based on this. And Twitter's just so short when it comes to the actual way you communicate that it's easy to get involved with other people's thoughts as opposed to Facebook or Google Plus, which could be a very long, drawn-out, monstrous post about the Clydesdales and how touching it was. But, you know, on Twitter, it's got to be short. So I think Twitter, they're doing very well with this.
Tom, I know you spend...
I'm really curious. These hashtags here, can we really call a hashtag a win for Twitter? Or is this just a proxy for a catchphrase? If you've got a hashtag there and you use Twitter, obviously, you know... This is where you put hashtags. You put a hashtag in the search field. You look for it. You find all these other people who are talking about the same thing because they know how to use hashtags in Twitter. But if not, if you're not coming from a Twitter background, or if you're using these hashtags other places, what's to stop you from using a hashtag on Google Plus, for instance? Couldn't it just be a proxy for this is a catchphrase?
That's a great point because hashtags are... They do show up on Facebook, even though that's not an official thing. They do show up on Plus, and I think that's actually supported.
Mm-hmm.
But hashtags, I think, right now are still closest tied to Twitter. That's a really interesting point. I didn't even think of it that way.
Yeah, I guess you can use a hashtag on Facebook, right? I was surprised at this number being so high for Twitter, and I think it points out a problem Facebook has. I don't think Facebook has a usage problem, and I think Facebook is going to move into mobile just fine. And I said on This Week in Tech yesterday that ads will move from one place to another. They will move to mobile and the revenue will go up. We don't know how far, but it always does. But Facebook's problem may be that it's harder to market on. Twitter's dead easy. You create an account, you start pushing it out there. People can follow super easy. There's not this war like, oh, I have all these privacy settings. I have to decide whether to give, you know, access, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That may be a big advantage as far as marketing goes to pushing your message out there. Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Resumator, new sponsor on Tech News Today. This episode brought to you by The Resumator, the hiring solution for small and fast-growing businesses. One of the reasons we brought him on board as an advertiser is Leo and Lisa, our CEO, have been using it to look for candidates. If you're a business executive, a hiring manager, an HR professional at your business, this is a way to reduce time spent on hiring tasks by 50% and reduce the amount you spend, the cost per hire, by as much as 85%. Try replacing your HR inbox or a clunky applicant tracking system for hiring with The Resumator. It's an end-to-end hiring package that helps manage the entire process of hiring, from attracting great applicants to selecting your next employee. We're beginning to use it right here at TWIT. We've grown significantly in the past few years, and it's always difficult to figure out how do we find the good people. There's lots of great people out there. We know that just from our chat room, but how do we make sure we're getting everybody? And we're excited that's going to help us be more efficient. Instagram, Pinterest, and Tumblr got off the ground with the Resumator. Here's how it works. First, it helps you with sourcing. So you can attract applicants to your jobs using your website, free job boards, social media connections. Helps you screen the applicants so you can rank them, track them, discuss resumes to identify top qualified applicants in the talent pool. And it helps you with the interview process. Schedule meetings with the candidates, collect feedback from the team on potential hirees. And it helps you hire them. You can use it to collaborate and compare to select the best person for the job. Manage the flow of incoming applicants, the pre-screening process, the communications, all that stuff can sound like a nightmare when you're hearing me talk about it. ResumeMator makes it easy. You can focus on getting the right people. Focus on aspects of your business that need your attention and spending time organizing resumes and files. If you're a business owner, hiring manager, or HR professional, and you want to save time, money, and increase traffic to your job postings, check out the ResumeMator. For a free trial, go to this URL. It's up on the screen right now. Or if you're on the audio podcast, it's theresumeMator.com/TNT. And after the free trial, the base package is $99 per month, covers 5 open jobs and 5 users, and they offer other packages as well. We thank ResumeMator for their support of Tech News Today. All right. We have a lot of people trying different ways of selling ebooks, but this is the first I've heard that sells them to you by the page.
Yeah, there's a new company out there called Total Books. It's got a new model for ebooks. Like Tom mentioned, they sell them by the page. Its founder, Yoav Orch, said that the old book business model is counterproductive. With cost, if you're wondering, hey, are you going to be paying a lot more for a book if you don't read the whole thing? Turns out it's supposed to be proportional. So if you read about 10% of the book, you'll pay about 10% of the price. If you read the whole book, you'll pay the same price you would if you bought an ebook outright. It's got a catalog of 10,000 books. It will be available on iOS and the web. An Android version is in closed beta, and that's going to roll out by the end of the month. Sean, what do you think of this model? Could it be disruptive, or are they too small a player?
Oh, it's going to be really hard to jump into the market at this point with all the established players, you know, like Amazon and then Nook with Barnes & Noble and so on, Kobo and beyond. But I think it'd be very difficult to jump in. But I like the idea. I do really like the idea. I think it's got some potential because you do pick up books sometimes and you read a ways through them and you think you like them, but then you decide you don't. You just put them down. Same thing for video games and movies. You'll watch a bit. You'll decide, especially with video games, if it's a long 60-hour game, you'll be playing a bit of it at a rental, and you'll decide, you know, you're done with it. You've only spent a few dollars. But if you buy a game at $60, it's a lot more investment. With books, it's a little bit less, I suppose. But the same idea being, you know, that you'll want to use a little bit of it. You'll decide you don't like it, and then you say, well, where'd the rest of my money go? What did I spend all this on? And you'll try to pawn it off on a friend or something. That said, I almost don't want this to work, because I don't want authors to artificially inflate the page counts of their books by putting in useless text in order to get you to read more and give them more money. If you really do like the book, I don't want them to artificially extend it.
Sarah, what do you think about the pay-per-page method of selling an ebook?
I think it is, I hate the word disruptive, but yes, it's a unique approach to this ebook model. But yeah, I mean, almost the opposite of what Sean just said. It's almost like, I don't know. I mean, when I start reading a book, unless for some reason I am just like really offended by it or something, I mean, I'm probably going to finish it. And if I have more of an incentive to just bail out after 2 chapters, even if I had really, really stuck around to chapter 7, I'd end up really loving the book. And that happens all the time to me, where it takes a while to kind of get into it. I just don't know if that's, a great incentive for user habits.
Tom, do you think this method would work for all kinds of books, fiction, nonfiction? I mean, what would you want to buy only a portion of?
Fiction, nonfiction, periodicals. I think this is intriguing. My first reaction was the same as Sarah's. Like, if I pick up a book, I generally finish it, even if I'm not loving it. I want to get through and see how it ends. But nonfiction, maybe I don't. And this is sort of halfway between the free chapter and the full book, right? I mean, we do this with TV shows all the time. You watch TV shows and then maybe after a few episodes, you're like, I can't take it anymore. I don't like it. I'm going to bail. You could do that with books now, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. You could start reading down the line and say, you know what? I think I've got everything I need out of this nonfiction book. Or say, you know what? I don't really like the story, and not feel like you have to finish it because you bought the whole book. I'm not sure how many people will jump on board of this. I'm not sure how many publishers are going to cooperate with this model either. But it's intriguing. I think I would like to try it just to see. And if I read it right, is the idea that the book full price stays the same as buying the full book. So it's not in the author's advantage to pad the thing, because the price of the book's going to be the price of the book. It's in the author. It's to the author's advantage to make sure that each page is very compelling and keeps you reading.
At the bottom of every page, to be continued.
And then there was a wolf.
I mean, yeah, maybe this could give birth to like a new genre, a new type of fiction, where that is that's the entire idea. You know, you have to make your book exceptionally long, but also very compelling page to page, so that you want to keep reading through the whole thing. You'd have these long books, like a long TV series, basically, where they have, you know, new things in each episode to keep you going.
What I think of immediately when I hear about this is textbooks at school. If they could just roll that in, that'd be perfect for students. You need to read chapter two? Cool. I'll just buy chapter two. Not reading chapter four? Great. I never paid for it.
And then you find out that you only had to pay about $20 for that year's semester's information.
Exactly.
That's true, because there's some. Well, I'm thinking about classes now. Uh-huh. That does happen a lot, where you don't have to read the whole thing.
Right.
Or you drop the class.
Exactly.
I'm just thinking, could you charge more for other pages? Like, choose your own adventure? You know, if you want the wolf to show up, pay more money. If you want a Smurf to show up, it'll cost you less. Or that might be more licensing, actually.
Hey, what do you got against Smurfs? All right, let's talk a little bit about Wacom, or Wacom, depending on who you ask. I know a lot of illustrators and artists use this. Even some people who just want an interesting pointing device sometimes use these tablets. But now Samsung has taken a distinct fiduciary interest in it.
Good word, Tom. Yeah, 5% stake. In other words, for, I always say Wacom because I like to think of like whack-a-mole.
I say Wacom too.
It's just kind of fun, but I'm sure there's a professional out there who's like, don't say it that way, it's Wacom. Samsung has bought 5% of the company for $58.2 million. So quite a bit of money for a small stake. But the Galaxy Note line is very popular, has had strong sales. Samsung has already used Wacom pressure-sensitive tech for the Style I in those models. Wacom says that Samsung's investment is going to be used for product development and manufacturing and supply chain enhancements for Samsung supplied products by March of this year. So it all kind of makes sense. Obviously, Samsung is committed to having products that have a stylus option. And on the surface, it's sort of like, well, you know, they're just getting into the game a little bit more. But does anyone think that there's more to it? Is it some sort of a super stylus that we haven't seen before, because maybe they haven't been able to take it to the next level because they needed a little bit more money, you know, to the tune of almost $60 million from Samsung? I guess I don't actually have any tablets or devices where I use a stylus regularly, but I know particularly on an iPad, say, there are certain apps that if you're artistically inclined, or even some sort of like CAD software type stuff, people will swear by a stylus. That's what you have to do to take it to the next, not just consumption, but creation level on a device. But those are all aftermarket. I mean, Apple doesn't bundle anything in like that. So I wonder if Samsung really committing to having a stylus as a feature on more of their phones and devices is a good thing. Does it set them apart, Tom?
It definitely could set them apart. I'm not sure if it sets them apart in a good way or a bad way. Remember when the S Pen first came out, a lot of people made fun of it. Now, there are some aficionados out there, but mostly people think, why do you need a stylus? I think when Steve Jobs said, the best stylus is the one you've always got with you, your finger, to totally paraphrase him, I think a lot of people buy that, especially once they've started using iPads and Android tablets that don't have styluses. That's not to say that there couldn't be some great niche devices that integrate with Wacom in some pretty cool ways, but it's not a massively popular thing as far as I would think.
Well, I suppose the Galaxy Note did pretty well. I believe it did 5 or 10 million or something like that fairly quickly. And it is one of the first devices to really bring the stylus to regular consumers. I just thought it was funny, though, that the biggest screen that you could possibly have, that's the one where they give you the stylus, where you don't need that pinpoint precision necessarily unless you're drawing. That's the one where they give you the stylus. Whereas with some of the smaller screen devices, if you want to tap on something very tiny, it helps to have a pen of some sort with that kind of precision. By the way, Wacom is Japanese, so it's Wacomu.
So somebody in the chat was saying it was Washington. It's Japanese?
Japanese.
Good to know.
Headquartered in Japan.
Well, whatever the company's called. The fact that Samsung likes to control supply chains, and if they can get a stake in that company, I'm not going to say it now, and be able to get either discounts or get maybe a priority in getting these styli, that could help them out in the long term. Because the Samsung devices do very well. They sell well, and if they can get profit margins higher by just doing an investment in Wacom. I think it's Wacom, actually. I've talked to somebody at the company. But I have no idea at this point. And if they can get a priority there and they keep prices down, then Samsung will keep rolling in the dough, because every quarter seems like they're making record profit. If this is the way to do it, it probably makes a lot of sense for them.
Or is it record profit? Anyway. I think, Sarah, we need some wine, don't we?
Yeah, you got crunchy there. You need some wine.
We all need some wine. Ayaz, what kind of wine you got for us?
I've got an emulator, or not an emulator, for you guys. Alexander Juilliard showed off a demo of wine running on Android. Now, this would let you run Windows applications on an Android device. Now, Juilliard is the project lead for Wine. If you ever used it, you can run Windows applications on Linux that way. Wine stands for Wine is not an emulator, and that's what it stands for. Performance, though, if you guys are wondering, how did it do? Horrendously slow, according to Phoronix.com, but performance problems were attributed to running Android itself in an emulator. Just a flat-out nerd question. Sean, how cool is this?
This is not that cool. I mean, as a proof of concept for people who are, you know, junkies like myself, it's cool. But as far as actually the idea of ever using this, we've already seen ARM devices with Windows on them, the Windows RT at least. And Microsoft made the decision not to put the full legacy Windows apps on these devices for a reason. I mean, the performance is going to be horrible. Maybe as the ARM chips get more powerful, we get a lot more of these, you know, Cortex A15s and beyond that can really power some applications. It might be useful occasionally if you've got a legacy app that, you know, some old piece of CAD software, something that you really, really need to hold on to. But I don't know that I'd ever use this.
Tom, the other day we saw an article where somebody had run Photoshop for Windows 3.1 on his Android device, and we thought it was really cool. What do you think about this?
I love Wine. I mean the emulator, not an emulator. I also love the drink, but this is awesome. I think it's fun. Is it going to have practical uses? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, there's some great practical uses for Wine. I've used it over the years to run Lotus notes in my Zandros install back in the day. I've used it to run lots of cool stuff in other areas. I've used the Wine outgrowth project on OS X to run Windows apps on OS X. I'm always looking for this kind of thing to break down the walls between platforms. Ever since the days where, like, your computer came with its own OS and never worked on any other kind of computer, you know, your Commodore 64, your TI-99, I've wanted that day when we were all on the same platform and it just didn't matter. You bought a computer and it ran the apps. It feels like with tablets and smartphones, we're going farther away from that. So stuff like this always gets me excited.
So beyond the whole nerd question, a regular question. Sarah, do you think running full desktop applications on a phone would appeal to the masses, or is it just strictly all nerd?
I don't think it's going to appeal to the masses. I know it's going to appeal to a lot of people who are listening to our conversation right now. No, I think that this is a, hey, that's cool because you can type of a thing. Doesn't mean it's not worth it. I think these sorts of do-it-because-you-can projects are really important. But no, I don't think this is a mass adoption type of a technology.
I tend to agree with you on that. Like, I think it's cool because you can do it, but I don't know what the practical use will be such that everyone's like, oh, I want to use this. I think there's a reason why applications are written specifically for certain platforms.
Yeah. If you could get Microsoft Office running on Android and Wine really reliably and well, then yeah, that would be a huge hit. The problem is you generally can't get it running as well as the mass audience wants it to run to feel comfortable with it. So it's cool, though. Let's finish with the randomizer. Complex.com has a list of the 25 craziest things ever said by tech CEOs. Great stuff in there from Steve Jobs, from Eric Schmidt, from Michael Dell. We just mentioned the Michael Dell quote from 1998 where he said Steve Jobs should just, the Apple should just dissolve the company and give the money back to the shareholders. How that's sort of haunting him in these days when he's trying to take the company private again. But I don't know if you guys have peeked at this already and seen what the number one was, but any guesses?
I would think that 640 kilobits thing by that's attributed to Bill Gates would be number one.
Is it kilobits or kilobytes?
Kilobytes.
I can't remember.
It's kilobytes.
But yes, it is in there, and they make a point of saying that Bill Gates consistently denies that he ever said that. But they also point out that he probably said something like that at the trade show that he is purported to have said it, something like 640K, which is, you know, probably enough for all users these days. And he probably said it in such a way that it got misquoted. But the number one is actually similar to that in that a lot of people say, well, that's not what he meant. Ken Olson was the founder of DEC Computing. And in 1977, he said, "There is no reason for any individual to have a computer in his home." And this was quoted in Time magazine. Now, since that time, Olson said that he was talking about big computers, not personal computers. He was talking about home automation type stuff. But he didn't clarify it at the time. And there's never been a transcript released. So does that win?
Yeah.
I mean,
they said his house. So I feel like he wasn't even talking about 50% of the population anyway.
I don't think it's fair
to
even have
half the people.
I don't think it's even fair to have like these really old statements be at the top of this. I mean, like hearing Steve Ballmer saying the iPhone won't be anything or anything Eric Schmidt says, like in today's climate and culture, those things are way more like crazy than it would be back then. I just think that was a lack of foresight versus now saying that, oh yeah, if you don't like us with Google Maps, you could just move.
Just move.
Like,
yeah,
that's crazy. Much crazier than half the stuff on this list.
I have to say, number 17, Eric Schmidt, "We know where you are. We know where you've been. We can more or less know what you're thinking about." That's pretty creepy.
"We are coming for you. You heard, biological and technological distinctiveness will be added to our own." All right, let's take a final break and thank our other new sponsor. Welcome to the show, Podio from Citrix. Of course, Citrix has supported Tech News Today for a long time, but Podio is one of their newer products. All the information needed for your workday, living in a million different places. Think about it. You've probably got people sending you email for things, and you're trying to manage a project through email, and then somebody's got a spreadsheet that they forward around, and every time it gets changed, they forward a million of these things. Documents all over the place. It's disorganized. It's impossible to manage. Priorities are always shifting. It's chaos. Podio by Citrix is the solution. Podio allows you to manage all projects back and forth, instant communication, and workflow from one easy-to-use platform, allowing you to work the way you want to. You have total flexibility with Podio. Customize your collaborative workspaces to manage your products. You can start deliverables. You can assign people roles. Bring any team together. And you can put your coworkers on there, but you can also put your clients. You can put your external contracts. So you're not always working with just people in your company. Whoever you want to be on the project, whoever needs to be on that project is in there. You and your team can work from any mobile device. They have a great mobile app. In fact, the iPad app is pretty significantly awesome. We've started using it here at Twit to kind of get all the cats herd it into one place, send them in the right direction. So start using Podio today. And you know what the best part is? You can start using it right now for free. I don't need to give you a special code or anything. Just start using Podio. It's Podio today. It's free. Visit podio.com. Sign up. Set up your first workspace. Invite your team to get started. Work the way you want with podio.com. And we're happy to have them on board with Tech News Today. Sarah, what's on the calendar?
Well, Tom, Andrew Sullivan's big experiment, you might be familiar with him. He wrote The Dish over at The Daily Beast and went off on his own to start a reader-supported online journalism effort. It's now live. He raised quite a bit of money, over $500,000. So we'll have to see how it goes, but looks like a strong start for something that's, you know, that's kind of a scary thing to do. Tomorrow, also scary, perhaps, Zynga's earnings. we'll cover them as soon as we have them for the show. And the PlayStation Vita arrives in ice silver in Asia on February 28th. So if you like the color and you live in Asia, it's going to be a fun month.
That's my 13.5 favorite color.
Really?
Ice silver.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's move on to what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got a voicemail from an IT professional with a perspective on our discussion of IT locking down machines for security.
Hi, my name is Matt. I work for actually a government group that deals with cyber forensics, and I've worked in IT and consulting for years. And I was listening to the show the other day about the hacks on Chinese attacking one of the groups and the issues with IT. And just wanted to share that a lot of times the IT company or IT groups, we're trying to lock them down. But when, you know, Secretary Susie can't have her kitten running across the bottom of her email, she gets upset and complains. So we're constantly in this constant battle with upper management on being able to lock down items. It seems to be an ongoing battle. So just thought I'd let you know, it's a lot of times the IT guys completely happy with locking it down and shutting them all out because we do believe they're all pretty much stupid. So thanks. Love the show.
Wow. He just out and out called them stupid there at the end. But I think this is emblematic of the battle, right? IT wants their solution to be simple. They just want to lock everything down, whether you need it or not. Lock it down if it's risky. And then you've got, on the other extreme, you've got the guy who wants the kittens running across his screen, who just wants to be able to do whatever he wants, even though he doesn't follow proper behaviors. The solution's got to be somewhere in the middle there, right? I mean, come on.
Well, maybe more cats and security software. If the security software had cats, we have no problems.
Secure a cat.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an email from Tyler. He said, hello, TNT crew. I was listening to Friday's show. I'm amused at Sarah Lane's revisit of the, I'm just going to spell these now, G-I-F pronunciation debate, and have a question for Tom Merritt. If you pronounce G-I-F as J-I-F, how do you pronounce J-I-F-F? There is a little-known file extension, J-I-F-F, which I think of every time someone incorrectly pronounces G-I-F. Thank you.
Well, I went and did a little searching, and I found a Gizmodo article that points to The Atlantic, which quotes the specs of the GIF specification. The pronunciation of GIF is in the spec to be GIF, as in Jiffy, rather than GIF, which most people seem to prefer. This does seem strange because the G is from the word graphics and not graphics, which is usually the argument about saying GIF. But I would ask Tyler, how do you pronounce G-I-A-N-T?
All right, got another email from Rill in Middleton, Wisconsin, who says, my grandmother, who was born in 1902, wore a bone conduction hearing aid for most of her adult life with no ill effects. I think Google using bone conduction rather than a device in your ear is marvelous. As a blind person, I never use earphones when I'm navigating with my seeing eye dog on the street. I need to listen for traffic and pedestrians and to understand what's going on. Google Glass could be a great help to the blind with easily heard navigation instructions and identification of buildings that you're passing. Currently, I can navigate with my phone, but it can only announce street names and numeric addresses. I can imagine navigating with Glass and being told where the library is, what side of the street it's on, where to find the entrance. Don't get me wrong. Dogs are fantastic, being able to find a way to the door of the building, but the human part of the equation, me, needs to tell the dog which building to enter. Over time, the dog figures out where you are in the library's vicinity, and you might want to go there. So that's, it's a little bit of follow-up on our conversation from last week when I said, it's going to sizzle your brain. No. And it sounds like there could be some really
important point. It's a really, really important point. When you talk about these, you know, the Google Glass and the self-driving cars and a lot of this crazy technology that you think, well, this is going to be amazing someday, but there's probably no market for it today and it's going to cost so much money and who's going to want to pay, you know, that much for something like that? You've got to remember that there are people with disabilities who could really, really use these things for a whole variety of ways. I mean, we saw the video from Google about the self-driving car. The person, I think it was a blind person in that car as well, who was able to get this ride, you know, to and from where they needed to go because the car could take them there. And the similar thing with Google Glasses, it could help people who can't see, who can't hear, perhaps. It could visualize sound waves for them, could be another application for it. We've got to keep this in mind, I think.
That's cool stuff. All right, thanks, Cyril, for the email. And thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. Sean Hollister, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Glad we had one of the stories you were posting on The Verge to talk about today. But let folks know where they can find you online and all your other stuff.
Yeah, it's www.theverge.com. TheVerge.com. Not hard. See you there.
You can find our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. That's the place to go to submit stories, submit links. Let us know. You can even just vote on the stories that other people are submitting. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about on the show. You can also email us. Our email address is tnt@twit.tv. You can give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. Our URL to locate our page and all of our episodes and all of our links is twit.tv/TNT. Aya will be out tomorrow, unfortunately. But Simon Dingle will be on the show with Sarah and Aya, and I will see you on Wednesday.